one idea. You have, in order to understand that one idea. So I'm not going to pretend that it's understandable in the form that is now given. I just want to show that underneath this particular theory of madness is that idea in all its complexity. Okay, but just hold that for a moment. Here, the person is told to do something spontaneously, which by its very nature is not spontaneous. Or to do something deliberately, which by its very nature is spontaneous. Either way, he got you in what is called a double bind. He's got you coming and going. If you obey, then you have disobeyed. If you disobey, then you've obeyed. The layman's way of putting it is you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. Okay? Now, the third characteristic, I'll come back to the paradox. Third characteristic is called disqualification, which is to say that the unlabeled patient denies that he has given any order. And that's called disqualification, and I'll get into that in some detail. Or denial, negation, whatever you like. And that therefore, if he denies that he's given an order to do this thing spontaneously, then the labeled patient's response cannot be a matter of obeying orders, can it? So he has disqualified in advance the labeled patient's response to his paradoxical order. Okay. So that any symptom, any tactic, is the labeled patient's response to that situation. So any symptom, no matter how deeply embedded within the person and no matter how typical and characteristic of the person, is situationally determined. Okay. Now back to the paradox. That's the definition of a double bind situation. Yeah. That there's this kind of relationship, paradoxically injunctive is given and then disqualified. Okay, when the victim of a double bind situation must opt for only two alternatives, both of which yield the same result, he is said to have an illusion of choice. Heads I win, tails you lose. Do you prefer six or half a dozen? This example of seeming alternatives are, of course, puns and are quite obvious. But the apparent choices in a double bind situation are never obvious. Or rather, that they both lead to the same outcome is not obvious. All the victim has is a vague, gnawing feeling he's being had somehow, called the double take. That's what goes with illusions, confusion, puzzlement, and a sort of nonplussed double take. When you get zapped with a disqualified paradoxical injunctive, something's wrong, but you don't know what it is, and you don't know what to do. You're puzzled. Now, jumping ahead a bit. Sleep is a way out of the double bind situation because it dissolves the illusion of choice. Going into a hypnotic trance at one stroke disqualifies the binder's message, one's response to it, and the binder's response to one's response. In other words, you go to sleep. Now, I haven't talked about sleep or hypnosis. I've got to talk about that too. Because it ain't what you think. Well, sleep is what you think. Hypnosis is sleep. But that's the way a person gets out of a double bind situation intact with his pride, without feeling ashamed of himself. He goes to sleep in some degree. Okay? It wipes out the whole double binding context. Small wonder then that such a powerful maneuver is used more than those who suffer, more by those who suffer deficit in self-esteem than by those who don't. Everybody uses the trance for various purposes, both constructive and destructive, but it's the insane person who spends more time in somnambulisms than out. Someone who is chronically ashamed of himself, who is caught in a double-bind situation, is especially prone to go somnambulistic and do something crazy before, okay. So that's jumping ahead. Now I want to talk about how tactics are relationship defining in this context. And I want to get into this idea of paradox and disqualification in detail. Haley says that symptoms convey a message, and the message inevitably defines the relationship the sender is willing to have with the receiver. It's because messages define relations that they are used as tactics. The more ashamed a person is of himself, the more he'll bend his communications to relationship definition control. Relationship definition goes on all the time, anytime there's communication, but a power struggle to see who's going to control the definition of relations waxes and wanes along with the self-esteem of one or both participants. With the onset of a power struggle, tiny little household issues, such as who's going to carry a cup back to the kitchen, become battles, some ending in homicide. Who's in charge is the issue, not the cup. Dear, I'm going to let you empty the ashtrays, says the housewife, quite innocently and, in her view, quite justifiably. After all, look at all the services she's rendered. She renders unasked and without appreciation from her spouse. Surely it's not too much to ask, indeed it is even trivial, that he lend a hand in picking up. But suppose the husband is ashamed of himself for some shortcoming. He's on the spot. If he acknowledges the message, he has but two choices. If he acknowledges the message, dear, I'm going to let you empty the ashtrays. So if he acknowledges this message, let's see, if he acts as if he heard it, notice that he has the alternative of acting as if he didn't hear it. That is, he treats it as a disinformation. But say he opts. He doesn't have the presence of mind to be deaf. The absence of mind, I should say. Okay, if he acknowledges the message, he has but two choices. One, he can comply, in which case he will be more ashamed of himself. He can disobey, in which case he will be more ashamed of himself. He's ashamed if he does, and he's ashamed if he doesn't. So he makes a cutting remark in either case, and the game is on. Now that's a double bind, triggered by a seemingly quite innocent remark. Now, let's look at that remark. Very important that you see in that innocent little remark why that puts him on the spot. Two things must now be shown. Namely, how is it that both choices lead to increased shame for the husband, and how the innocent remark of the wife is not innocent at all? We may also profit if we examine the concept of triggering. Let's begin with the latter. When you pull the trigger, you set off a charge that's already loaded and ready to go off with a minimum nudge or fuse. The size of the explosive charge is independent of the size of the fuse. The trigger is like the last straw. So when the wife looks at her in an innocent remark, which is rather unlikely, she is quite mystified to see how that could have in any way occasioned the hassle that ensued. nor would she understand even if it were explained to her, because she'd have to see why such a remark puts her husband into a double bind sometimes and not others, owing to fluctuations of self-esteem. So let's see what her remark, quote, really says. First, she says, dear, instead of you lazy bum, thus indicating her benevolence. The person who is one up in the metacomplimentary relationship always presents himself or herself as benevolent, bene volens, goodwill, well-meaning. It's only for your good, that sort of thing. Okay. By saying, dear, she qualifies the rest of the sentence with her goodwill. Okay. Second, she says, she'll permit him to work. Going to let you do something. Now, a net complimentary message like that presumes that he, in some sense, asked if he could work, or that he should work and knows this. By her saying, I'm going to let you do this, I'm permitting you to do this, presupposes that he thinks he should do this, or even more, that he asked if he could do this. So the little innocent, I'm going to let you, is loaded with power. Now, whether or not he should work at picking up is presented as not negotiable, is it not? They're not going to have an argument now, they can't, about whether he should or not. That's put out of bounds as something that's not even negotiable. Of course he should. That's a given. So he can't, of course, not that the poor guy could analyze all this and see what's going down the tubes. He just knows he doesn't even know he's been had. That's why it's confusing, subtle, but there's that double take, there's a feeling like a big hook just went into you. The less well you feel about yourself, the more this is felt. If you're feeling real good about yourself, you hardly notice it, yeah.
He turned around and commented on it, and that would kind of mean, like, what do you mean you're men?
Well, now you got yourself a fight.
He was commenting on the message.
No, he didn't comment. He asked a question.
Okay. So say he doesn't put it in now, right? But that, and he said, if you act like that, that would be a statement.
No. Question is a command to reply in a certain way. All questions are commands. So that would increase his shame, because it makes him an ingrate. And a loafer. Well, she wouldn't understand what he's talking about. Well, oh, you beast, you. After all I've done, you come on with your damn logic, or something like that. God, I don't know. We'd end up, but that won't do it either.
So just desperate, no matter what. There's no way of desperate praying, other than leaving the field.
Well, you got to be damn bright to step outside that frame, and most people aren't, especially when they're not feeling good about themselves.
But if you are feeling good about yourself,
oh well, nothing happens.
You say,
sure. Then don't do it. Forget it. Something like that.
Fall asleep.
That's the way I do it. Okay, whether or not he should work at picking up, as Brandon said, is not negotiable, just as whether or not he is going to do it is presented as not negotiable. Notice that. Whether he should is not negotiable, and whether he will is not negotiable in the form that it is put. I'm going to let you. Dear. Yeah.
He can go ahead and do it if he can comment
he's automatically one down if he complies. And he's automatically one down if he disobeys. Huh?
The sickness comes when the guy is has so low an opinion of himself that this is felt like a, he feels this one like a stab in the gut. You know, it's like a mortal wound to him if he empties the ashtrays, or if he empties them and comments about it, or if he doesn't and says go to hell or something. If he disobeys, he feels bad about himself. If he obeys, he feels bad. That's why, see, it's double bind. Either way he jumps, the two alternatives that he has are both damaging to him. Yeah.
Well, no, that's not going to help his feelings about himself. Well,
that is an out of it, you see. Because she'll retort now. She'll pick up the sarcasm like that and come back with, "So are you ingrate?" Yeah. Oh, no. I'm trying to show how very innocent ordinary conversation given to somebody that feels lousy about himself is double binding.
No. It's just an innocent comment.
Yeah. It takes two to tango.
Yeah.
Well, okay. This is all hypothetical. I just made this up, so I can't tell you about any particular case. But that kind of talk is double binding by its very nature, no matter who you say it to. Paradoxical injunctive.
Right. Are they also acting?
Well, they are if they are, and they aren't if they aren't. See, you're forgetting this part here. Remember if there is no intense meta-complementary exchange going on, then and a paradoxical injunctive is giving, it doesn't go anywhere. Nothing happens. Yeah.
I do recall one instance in talking in Keith's class about this, that he said that, you know, leaving the field really is not going to remove the double bind situation. I'm not sure of the accuracy of that or not. Some people feel leaving the field will remove the situation. I don't think it will,
part of
to a degree. Okay, but he did say the point here is a way to get around feeling the sting or the hook or whatnot is to say, you know, sweetheart, you call her sweetheart because she called him dear. I was just about to empty the ashtrays, and I'm glad you mentioned it. And furthermore, I really noticed that the waste paper basket needs to be emptied, and I'm going to empty that too. Mm-hmm. And that way, you remove the, you know, sense of this command is something that's coming to you, responding as though it's...
If you got yourself that much together, you wouldn't even need to do that.
Because
just let it go.
Does a meta-complementary relationship imply that someone is not feeling or someone is?
Yeah, this wouldn't come to be the standard exchange if the person weren't way down in the relationship. See, another name for this is dependency, that we have one person dependent on the other in a very vital way.
We're not even talking about
sweetheart. Oh, no. way.
Well, no, he could be.
They are very unequal, like an adult and a child. Think of this as an adult and a child. I'm using a spouse relationship, but there's a big gap between the amount of muscle that the two have. That's why one's got the other one in this one-down position, chronically one-down position. So, you know, it may sound easy to get out of this one with your skin intact, but when you're talking about extreme differences in muscle and power in the relationship, no way. The person just got another wound. Now, you can go to sleep and get out of it. And now I want to talk about that at length, but let me go finish this. Okay, that he should work is not negotiable. That he will work is not negotiable. These are both taken for granted. Okay, by that double binding or paradoxical injunction, those are cut out as possibilities. All of this is presupposed in the benevolent "I'll let you, dear." She has the right that one. She has the right to tell him what to do. She's defining the relationship as one in which it's okay for her to tell him what to do. Isn't she? When you give an order to somebody, the meta message is, I have the right to tell you what to do. Okay? Two, he will do it. Three, he should do it. Four, he knows he should do it. All of those are presupposed in that one little sentence. Anything he does in response confirms her definition of the relationship. He can't disconfirm the definition because of the way it was put. That's why either course increases his shame. He confirms if he does, and he confirms if he doesn't. He ends up one down, way down in the relationship. Okay, mental illness might be thought of as a recurrent attempt to regain the one-up position by, instead of choosing to comply or not, see, he can comply or disobey, obey or disobey, can't he? Those are the illusory choices that he has. Remember, there's an illusion of choice. I can do that or that. I can obey or disobey. Those are my choices. Either one of them puts him one down. Okay, instead of choosing to comply or not, which most of us would do, he chooses to do something that has no relation to the command to pick up. Since such an action is clearly unresponsive and inappropriate to the situation, the wife sees it as odd or strange. If the husband can manage to qualify his action as involuntary or spontaneous, just happening of itself, so that it's not him doing it, then he has not only gotten out of the double bind, he's also not responsible for what he did do. Okay? This sort of maneuver preserves his self-respect, and that's why he uses it. He has canceled his wife's definition of the relationship by acting as if what he did wasn't in response to her message. At the same time that he indicates his behavior is not a message to her. It's not a response to her, and it's not a message to her. It happened of itself, so he didn't do it. But something from out of nowhere that doesn't mean anything. Now she's in a double bind. And of course, at first anyway, hasn't the faintest notion that she's in one or how to get out of it. How she responds to his non-message is another story entirely. He, on the other hand, is off the hook, but there's a price to pay for getting off. By acting crazy, he's jeopardized his relationship to his wife, and he can only do that so many times before she leaves. The crazier a person acts, the more money is drawn out of the relationship bank account. And that's one account that can't be overdrawn. Okay, now that strange action we tend to call symptom. That, you know, suppose a guy, she says, "I'm going to let you empty the ashtrays, dear," and he faints. Okay, what is fainting to do with ashtrays or the relationship? Nothing. See, the act is meaningless, and he didn't do it. And it's not a message to her, and it's not a response to her, is it? Yeah.
More drinking.
Well, no, and in that particular context, for him to go over and take a drink, or get a bottle and take a drink, would be a message. See, he's got to send a non-message that happens spontaneously. So he could suddenly jump up on the table and his eyes bulging out and shriek something meaningless, like he could gibberish, verbigeration, word salad, and you know, what? How could she construe this as related to her, or to her message, or to the situation? You see, it's he. Okay, now you can call that leaving the field. What it is leaving? It's jumping out of the context by doing something crazy. But it must be crazy. It's got to be orthogonal or unrelated to the situation, clearly unrelated to the situation, and clearly spontaneous or happening of itself. If she sees it and he sees it as something he's doing, quote, deliberately, voluntarily, then it won't work. He hadn't gotten out of the context. But if it's something, you know, let's say he has a seizure. He falls on the floor and starts jerking. Or half his body jerks. Well, sheesh. You know, what? Or maybe he has an attack of asthma. What has that got to do with emptying the ashtrays? Clearly nothing. So.
Isn't he his definition of symptoms? Like doing something and denying it?
Yeah. I'll get in disqualification. You see, not only by indicating that it is spontaneous behavior, not your behavior, by indicating that it is happening of itself, remember that word, that phrase, it happens of itself. It is self. The little man inside did it. Somebody else did it. I didn't do it. I had no control of it. It just happened. By qualifying your behavior as spontaneous and happening of itself, you disqualify it as a response to the command. And you disqualify it as a message to the significant other. You see, by making it crazy, you have denied responsibility, use, function, relationship, everything. You've dived everything. You jumped out of this context into another context. Now, this puts the other in a bind. How is the wife, what is she supposed to do if the guy throws a big, hairy, epileptic fit? Now, what's she supposed to do? Now that's crazy. You're good at this. Yeah. Okay, this strange action is called a symptom, or I call it a tactic. Its job is to regain control of how the relationship is defined, which it performs rather nicely. Because the partner in the relationship loses control and is forced into some kind of response to the other's nonsense, depending upon what sort of nonsense it was and upon the temperament of the partner facing the nonsense. Now, remember that when the sick one elects to counter with nonsense, he has to enter into a trance. D. Dealing with a person who's doing that sort of thing deprives one of all standard communication devices without the person realizing he's been so deprived. So it's rather paralyzing. So if you want to paralyze your spouse, have a seizure, or wet your pants, or all of a sudden take off all your clothes and scream, or climb the wall, you know, do something crazy. Because that paralyzes the other one, because they don't know what the hell to do that. You know, all standard communications are now aborted and preemptive. That the symptom is used to define a relationship is denied by the very nature of the symptomatic behavior, isn't it? That the symptom is used to define a relationship is denied. See, when the guy has the seizure, or maybe he does a ritual or something, does something insane or nonsensical, he is denying that the reason he's doing this is somehow related to the spouse who says, yeah, you can go ahead and empty the ashtrays. I'm going to let you. The partner, on observing the symptom, can't very well say, well, you had your grand mal seizure on purpose just to regain control of our relationship, of how our relationship is defined, even if he or she suspected it and even understood such things. The labeled patient who has the seizure does it unconsciously and involuntarily, and so would be justified in labeling the other's remark as unfeeling and malevolent. The point not to miss in all of this is that not only is the symptom a relationship-defining tactic, it's a disqualified relationship-defining tactic.
You said it was involuntary and unconscious.
That's right.
On the part of the husband.
Mm-hmm.
The fifth.
And I'll talk about involition or unwill and unconsciousness next time. I meant to talk about that before I talked about this. So I'm going to talk about sleep, hypnosis, and unconsciousness, because they're all the same, and will and volition, and unwill and involition, because we got to get these two ideas straight. Will and consciousness. So they're very, very important in understanding how one goes about designing a tactic that gets you out of a double bind.